to another episode of Adam's Corner. This week, I have the great fortune to be chatting with Mr. Pete Battistini. And Mr. Pete,
hello, Adam.
So welcome to the corner, as it were.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm going to give you a nice little intro here.
Okay.
And let people know. Now, we do have some listeners on my podcast who are across the pond, shall we say, over in the UK. So they may not be as familiar with Casey Kasem's American Top 40 as you and I would be. So I'm going to give a little, maybe just a little primer on that, I guess you would say. And that is for anybody listening to this who isn't familiar with this show, it was basically a show that played the hits of the day. It ran from 1970 and continues to run to this day with different hosts. But Casey Kasem was the original host, and a lot of you listening who aren't familiar with the show will know that him as a voice talent for Scooby-Doo and many other things. But that's just a quick primer for people who may be listening in another country, as it were, in some cases. So anyway, Pete has written these really just two tremendous books, and that's why we're here to talk about these books and his great work. American Top 40 with Casey Kasem, the 1970s, and then he came up with a second volume, American Top 40 with Casey Kasem, the 1980s, and these are just incredibly well-researched books with all kinds of interesting factoids about the show and just all kinds of really, if you are a fan of this show, as I am, you must have these books in your library. I don't know if they're still in print. I would hope they are, but I would say get them at any price you have to pay if they aren't in print. I've had mine for a while, so I haven't been checking to find out. But anyway, I'm going to stop yammering on, and I'm going to give you your opportunity to speak here. And so basically, I thought we would start things with a conversation about what your personal history is with the show, how you first discovered it and became enchanted with it, before we get into the actual subject of the books.
Okay, well, obviously that's a topic that is near and dear to my heart, because my interest in Hit Parade, quote unquote, on the radio actually started probably back in 1968. I started listening to a Chicago radio station, and soon after discovered that they printed a list of the 40 singles on their airplay every week. And they printed those off, and they were available at the counter of just about every record store in the Chicago area. And once I first discovered that, every week after, I went to the record store and I started collecting these listing playlists of Chicago's top 40. And I still have the original ones that, like I said, go back to 1968. Well, soon after that, probably about a year or so later, I was really interested in music, listening to Top 40 radio all the time, and I was about 14 then, and I soon found out about a TV show called Music Scene, and it was an ABC network program hosted by David Steinberg, and the reason that was interesting was because they had artists come on every week, like Three Dog Night and the Cowsills and others who were popular at the time, to perform their hit song. But David Steinberg and Music Scene apparently had some sort of arrangement with Billboard magazine, and every week they made reference to and actually showed an enlarged copy of like the Billboard Hot 100 or maybe Billboard's country chart, and maybe they play the number one song from the country chart and have that artist perform it there on the show. So I was introduced to Billboard magazine, and I was really intrigued because I didn't know that there was like a national chart available. And just things happened, and not too long after that, I actually came across a Billboard magazine. This is like late 1969 in a newsstand, and I bought it. I think it was like $1.25 or something, and took it home and just devoured the whole thing, especially when I got to the Hot 100, thinking, oh my gosh, look at all these songs. I've never even heard of these. And so, you know, it started, and I was buying Billboard maybe a couple times a month. I couldn't afford it every week. And so, a couple times a month, I go to the newsstand and buy one. And, you know, sometime in 1970, late 1970, early 71, I started seeing these news articles about this radio show that used Billboard's Top 40 from the Hot 100. And I was, again, intrigued by the fact that, okay, they're playing the Top 40. Then the radio station in Chicago at that point was not playing in countdown order their playlist every week. They would just play the songs, but they had no countdown. But then I learned about this national countdown, and that, you know, looking at Billboard every week or whenever I was able to get a copy, I saw the Top 40 for the week, and a lot of the songs I knew, there were some that I'd never heard because I didn't play them in Chicago. And so it was, you know, it's like, wow, well, I'd certainly like to hear the show. Well, you know, of course, the way things happened, I was with my family. We traveled I'm originally from Indiana, mm-hmm. and we traveled not too far to visit my grandmother on Easter Sunday in 1971. And again, such a Top 40 geek, I carried a radio with me, a transistor. And that Sunday, Easter Sunday, I happened to have the radio on after we had dinner, and I turned it on, and the radio station in her town, which was Terre Haute, Indiana, they were playing this countdown program, but at the time I didn't know what it was. And, you know, they were playing songs. It's like this, whoever was hosting the show was saying, well, this song's at, you know, number 32 or number 28 or whatever the case may be. And I thought, oh, okay, I got to write this down because, you know, I'm just kind of curious whether this was the program that I had read about in Billboard. And so when I got home, I had a current copy of Billboard, and I went and took my list, checked the Hot 100, and sure enough, that matched up. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is great. This radio program is on the air in Terre Haute, but it was not on the air in Chicago. And it took about a year before the program actually started on the air in Chicago. I was, of course, getting Billboard all the time and looking at the Hot 100 and imagining what it would be like to listen to this program, this Top 40 every week. But it wasn't until the summer of 1972 that it actually started on a radio station in Chicago, and I was able to hear it every week. But that's kind of the early years of my interest in American Top 40, and it just kind of blossomed from there. So,
yeah, you acquired, I think, some of the shows. The actual shows. There was an ad in the back of a magazine, I believe. That was the story that I remember. It might be in your book. And that kind of got you on to, this was years later, of course, collecting the actual shows. And I think you have one of the largest collections of the actual American Top 40 shows around, rather than, with the exception of maybe Shannon Lynn, who is doing the restorations on them, the ones that are syndicated around the country. But you have quite an impressive collection of the shows. And so I thought that was another interesting facet that you might want to talk about.
Yeah, actually, it was, I think it was 1976, I came across an ad, actually in the classified section of Billboard, of a guy who had worked with Casey, and he was unloading all of the American Top 40 shows that he had in his collection. And so, you know, he had almost every week, and I just couldn't believe that, you know, these programs were available, because they had been, initially they were issued to radio stations on reel-to-reel tapes, and that changed in October 1971 when Watermark, the American Top 40's parent company, decided that it would be more cost-effective and easier to distribute copies of American Top 40 issued on vinyl, and they actually produced a three-album box set every week and sent it to every radio station that subscribed to the show. And once those radio stations got the copy, they would get a new one the following week. The old one was like a newspaper. It's like, well, this has no value anymore. And so a lot of those shows got thrown away. But this guy that worked for Casey kept them, and he decided that he needed to, you know, unload them. You know, wanted to sell them, and he found me, or I found him, and it's like, wow, I couldn't believe it, because he had so many of these programs in his collection that I was never able to hear originally on the air. And so, you know, it's like I started, you know, gobbling these things up as best as I could. I was working two jobs at the time and trying to, you know, live a life and at the same time fork out some dollars to get these programs. And so that was pretty much the beginning of obtaining vinyl copies of the show from my collection. And it is it is quite extensive. I'm not afraid to say that there's no one that has a collection of American Top 40 material, which is more than just the shows. I have a lot of documents, memos, Casey's actual script cards, and a lot of radio station material that actually helps describe the history of the show. And I used a lot of those materials to produce the 1970s book, and then again the 1980s book. So there's a lot of illustration material along with descriptions of every program, and a lot of insight from some of the people that worked with Casey are, you know, in those books as well. And by the way, they are still available.
Good.
In fact, if I can give you my website, you can go to that website and it'll provide you with a link directly to the publisher, and anybody who's interested can buy them directly from the publisher. And so the website is at40book.com, at40book.com. So yes, they are still available, and I'm pleasantly surprised that the 70s book, which has been out like 20 years now, it's still its individuals are still going after it. And I have to credit Premier for that, because Premier issues the 70s and 80s programs every week.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful that I'm included in the closing credits of the shows. And so there are a lot of people. I think there's probably a couple hundred, 200 to 300 radio stations across the country that are either playing the 70s program and or the 80s program every weekend. And so it's just amazing that, you know, those programs are still alive and on the air. And but I mean, that'll tell you the quality of the production that Casey and all the people that worked for Watermark back in the 70s and the 80s. I mean, they knew what they were doing. And of course, Billboard was the source of their programs, and that, you know, for the most part has been the Bible of the record industry, and the source, the primary source of the charts that were used for the American Top 40 countdowns every week. So there's a lot of things that come together, that came together to produce the show, a top-notch program every week, and you know, it's just you know, continues to be alive and well, so to speak, even though let's see, it'll be 10 years I think in June that we've lost Casey. He's been gone that long, but nevertheless, his work is continues on, and certainly is part of his legacy.
Yes, absolutely, and it's the only time, I must admit, that I listen to commercial radio these days, is every weekend I make sure that I tune in and see which episode they're playing, which show they're playing. I personally have, I don't have the actual records or the radio station copies, but I do have them all archived digitally on a hard drive. So I have everything from, I think, the first show in 1970 to all the way to 2009 when Casey left. So officially left. So I have those. But yeah, I still, even though I have them, I still enjoy hearing them over the air, over the radio as well, you know, just commercial radio. And that's still a kick. And also on the satellite radio, they still do them on XM, Sirius XM. Too. So I was curious too about some of the more difficult shows to acquire as far as your personal collection. What were some of the hardest ones to locate? Like the Holy Grails, there's always those things that you're looking for and you just don't think you'll ever find them, and then one day they show up. And I was just curious about that.
Well, yeah, once I started obtaining the vinyl copies of the shows, it, you know, became kind of an obsession because, you know, you start a collection and then all of a sudden you've got a hole here and a hole there and trying to find one. I think probably the most difficult shows to obtain, and of course I have them all now, but at the time, during the 80s or 90s, when I was really very active with trying to fulfill the collection, probably one of the ones that are more difficult to obtain were the ones that actually were produced in 1971 when they originally went to vinyl, because the show was only on, oh, maybe 125 stations at the time. And again, as I mentioned earlier, you know, as an old newspaper, a lot of these radio stations, they threw these things away. They had no value because they couldn't play them anymore. And so, you know, there if there were 125 of these things produced in 1971, and 95% of them were trashed, there aren't many around still. But fortunately, over the years, I've been able to find those 1971 programs. And again, during the early years, the program wasn't on a lot of radio stations. It wasn't until probably the mid-70s before they really turned a corner, and they were, I think, on maybe 200, 300, 400 stations at that point in time. By the way, I'll go ahead and mention this. In mm-hmm. both of my books, I list every radio station that ever carried the show during the 70s, in the 70s book, and then again in the 80s, in the 80s book. You know, Casey mentioned and acknowledged every radio station that carried the show. Each week, he, you know, American Top 40 is heard on such and such a radio station. I mean, he mentioned that, I think, 3 or 4 stations per hour. And I went through every radio show, every American Top 40 radio show, to document that. And all of that is available in each of the two books. So,
yeah, it's
along
quite...
with the.
Oh,
I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead. I'm sorry. No, you say... go on.
No, that's okay. I just want to mention that there, you know, there's a lot of other radio station material in that particular section of the book. So, but every station that he ever acknowledged on the air, I documented, and it's easy to sort through because they're by state, alphabetized by state. You know, like in North Carolina, you know, there was New Bern. I think it was on in New Bern, mm-hmm. and of course a number of other cities there. But it's all alphabetized, and then. Every station around the world that carried the show, as long as Casey acknowledged it or was mentioned in the listener directory that that Watermark issued every year, I got them all in there. So there were quite a few stations,
Yeah, yeah, and I was just going to commend you on the hard work you did, obviously, because it's always a kick for me. I grew up listening to it on WBT, which was an AM station in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. I started listening around 1976 myself, And so it's a kick for me. And then later on, WBT had an FM sister station, which at the time was WBCY, 107.9 FM, and it eventually morphed over there. They started carrying it instead and on Saturday mornings. So it's a kick to me to listen to them and or look in your book and I see, oh, there's how many times they that they mentioned WBCY or WBT, and so it's kind of fun. The stations in my neck of the woods, as it were, that were carrying it. So that's just a really really great resource, and there are many others. We could give a quick overview of the show's history if you want to. I mean, we don't have to get into every little nuts and bolts detail, but it obviously started in July of 1979. July 1970 is what I meant to say. The July 4th weekend was the first show, and maybe you, if you want to, just give a quick history, just to let people know.
Well, I believe, and this has been disputed over time, that the show originally aired on 7 radio stations, and there's a few people that are not convinced that they actually may have been a few more. But in any case, it started on 7 radio stations. And one of the things that was really interesting about American Top 40 that I think added to its listener appeal was the fact that there were, especially during the early years, there were many, many specials, not only the year-end specials like the Top 40, or the Top 80, or the Top 100. But Casey and his staff came up with a number of unique themed programs that offered a little bit of a different aspect and a different insight to the Billboard charts. Like, for example, in the anniversary, 50 years ago, of the first week of weekend of April 1974, they produced a special called The 40 Most Extraordinary British Hits of the Rock Era. And so, of course, there were a lot of Beatles songs in there, Rolling Stones and so forth. But that was just one special they did. And then another one in 1976 for the Bicentennial, they actually, and this was really a unique special, Casey played the number one song on the 4th of July every year, starting in 1937. So he played the number one song of the 4th of July that year, the number one song 4th of July 1938, and just brought it up to 1976. And it was just a very unique, and obviously some of those songs were really, really obscure. And in fact, the Chicago radio station refused to play it because there were so many old songs, and literally old 30s and 40s and 50s, it just didn't fit their format.
Yeah.
And it was years later before I was able to get a copy of that show to actually hear it. But again, one of the most unique aspects of the early days in history of American Top 40, of all the specials that the Casey and his staff produced. And so that was really interesting. But and then another thing was aspect of it that I think is kind of interesting over the history are the number of guest hosts that came in and sat in for Casey from time to time. And, there are obviously some notable people. Dick Clark was one. Bob Eubanks from the Newlywed Game is another. Wink Martindale, who hosts, I think he hosted a game show.
He's kind of a, I believe, yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. There you go. And he's kind of a household name. And a number of other individuals from the radio, Top 40 radio world, that sat in for him over the years. And, I think that's another interesting aspect of the history of American Top 40. In fact, they had a woman sit in, Carrie Tombazian, mm-hmm. from a radio station in Los Angeles. The first time a woman ever appeared on American Top 40 show was, I believe, in 1983. And so, of course, things have changed quite a bit since then, but it was, again, quite unique at the time. So, it was just another aspect of American Top 40, I think, that offers something, you know, different and unique, and puts a spotlight on the show for another reason.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, and your book has all these just interesting facts. One of the interesting things in terms of the show's history is that Casey was actually recording the shows in real time, and then having,
right.
If they made a mistake, they had to go back and do it all over again. And I believe, and I may be mistaken on this, but it's been a while since I read the 70s book. I need to go back and redo it. But I think in your book you mentioned that it was Dick Clark who came up with the idea of tracking, which is where he just does the voice parts, and then they come in and add the other stuff in later. And he's like, you're doing it the hard way.
Yeah. You know, it was actually, you're absolutely right. And it was almost 2 years that every week Casey would go in and to the studio, and they recorded it like it was a live program. And again, you're right that when there were, he made a mistake, they had to go back and re-record a segment. And so, you know, that wasn't the easiest thing for Casey because, you know, he was involved with many other things at the time, and that just added to his time at the Watermark studio. But Dick Clark was indeed the individual that suggested that they voice track the show, and it was sometime, I'm not sure of the exact date, but probably April or May 1972 when they started doing that. And so that obviously relieved Casey of a lot of time and effort to, you know, have to sit and actually listen to every song in the top 40. So it was, you know, from his perspective, it certainly was a benefit. But yes, you're right. That's one of the interesting aspects of the history of the show, and obviously they continue to do that today. I mean, they never look back after that.
Yeah, well, that's the one contribution from Dick Clark, if nothing else.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's so in the beginning. Now, physically, I think I've read descriptions that the studio they recorded the early shows in, very small studio, about the size of a broom closet, I think, before the show actually took off.
It was in a small area. They didn't have much of a budget because American Top 40 initially, they had Casey as the voice, and a lot of people in radio knew him or knew how he sounded, but it was an unproven product, and it took a few years for the program actually to make a profit. But, they did, as you mentioned, they actually moved to a new studio in late 1972, and I think this was part of the voice tracking. But another thing that I know that you're aware of is initially the program was produced in mono because most of the radio stations at the time were AM, and there was no real reason to issue the program to stereo. But that changed in early 1973 because there were more and more radio stations playing Top 40 music on the FM dial. And so to accommodate those stations with the new studio, they had the capability of producing the entire program in stereo, and that was an added benefit to add more stations to the American Top 40 family. And so having the stereo aspect was at that point, a radio station couldn't say, well, we're an FM stereo station, your program's in mono, we don't want to air it. It was that excuse went out the window. And so the change in radio was on from Top 40 music on AM to FM, Watermark, American Top 40's president, present company, they were right with it. And so they've changed their capabilities for studios and had the ability to actually produce the program then in stereo. So that's another interesting aspect of the history of the show.
Yeah, a very important one too. I would definitely agree on that. Yeah, they Yeah, those early years were a bit challenging. There were, I think, times when Casey had to defer his salary to because he had such faith in the program and other people did not. And so he really kind of put his money where his mouth was, as they say.
Yeah, fortunately, Casey had other sources of income,
Yes.
and his partner at the time, Don Bustani, who actually then was writer and producer with American Top 40, in the early 70s, actually was one of the behind-the-scenes guy of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And so if you watch reruns of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, you'll see Don Bustani's name in the credits. And so, that was his, I believe, his source of primary source of income. And then Casey had his voice work with Scooby-Doo, and he did a lot of voiceover work with advertisers. And so, the American Top 40 aspect of the work there, it didn't pay the bills for those two. And but eventually it did, because obviously the program, became huge worldwide on more than 500 radio stations. And in fact, that's another interesting aspect. When ABC Radio bought Watermark in 1971, and that was another turning point in the history of American Top 40. But they had at that point probably, I think, at least 20 people on staff full time, either working with American Top 40 or the sister program American Country Countdown, or a number of other radio shows that Watermark was producing then. So Watermark, really, when they launched, they actually incorporated in 1969, American Top 40 was the first radio show. But a year later, they also produced the Elvis Presley special. And so actually it was the Elvis Presley story. It was a 12-hour documentary, and just, unheard of at the time. But it was very successful. And of course, when Elvis died in 1977, a lot of radio stations bought that program again and put it on the air in a tribute to Elvis. So, but there's more to American Top 40. I mean, their parent company, Watermark, really just, and Tom Rounds, the guy that ran that, he was a top-notch radio guy, and he knew what he was doing when they got that thing going, syndication company going, and it really laid the groundwork for a lot of other radio programs, syndicated radio programs. Rick Dees, of course, came along a little later, but it just syndicated radio was rewritten and became more popular, I believe, as a result of American Top 40 and Casey Kasem back in the 70s.
Yes, the contributions of that show were and its contributions to American culture and radio in particular are incalculable, I would say. So yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so we could talk a little bit, I guess, about the popularity of the show in the 80s as it went on. Casey eventually did a television version of the show where he would count down the top 10. Obviously, he didn't have time to sit there and do all 40 of the of the records, but he did that, and then eventually contract negotiations paved the way, unfortunately, for his exit from the show. So I guess we can talk a little bit about that stuff.
Yeah, the American Top 10 program was a half-hour show, I believe, back in,
Yes.
I think that started in 1980, and that certainly added to Casey's credibility as an expert on popular music, and he continued with American Top 40 as host until 1988, and his contract was up, and between himself, Casey, and ABC Radio, they weren't able to come to terms with Casey's value, so to speak. And so Casey left the show and actually went out and started Casey's Top 40, which started in January 1989. But meanwhile, American Top 40 continued on, they had to find a new host, and they ended up bringing on Shadow Stevens. And so Shadow Stevens hosted the show American Top 40 from 1988 until it went off the air in 1995. But, you know, again, Casey, I think, you know, ABC might have thought that they won the battle, but Casey certainly won the war, because his Casey's Top 40 program continued on until 1998. And at that point in time, Casey, American Top 40 had been off the air for 5 years. No, five, 90, 95, no, 3 years, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It was off the air for 3 years, and according to the legal terms, Casey became the owner of the rights to American Top 40 in 1998. And sure enough, we got another radio syndication company who had enough faith in the program, and they started American Top 40 with Casey Kasem again in 1998. And I believe it was March that year that Casey started doing the show, AT40, one more time. And that went on, I believe, until 2008, 2009. You might be a little bit more expert on that than I am.
Yeah, I think it was 2009. I think he eventually, he was kind of sort of giving the reins to Ryan Seacrest, but he was still doing the top 20, I think, or there was like another version of it or something where he was doing counting down the top 20 songs. It was like a shorter version of the show that was in some markets, and so I think, and then in, I think it was July of 2009, he finally decided that, you know, his health was, he was having some health challenges, as we, and we all know about what happened thereafter, unfortunately.
Right.
He was,
right.
The Lewy body dementia was getting to him and taking a toll on his voice, and so he unfortunately had to hang it up at that point. But 39 years, that's definitely a good run, I would say.
Yeah, you know, I was very fortunate to have numerous opportunities to meet with Casey one-on-one. In fact, there's an interesting story that the Indianapolis Star newspaper actually published an article about my collection sometime in the late 80s, I believe. And once it was printed, you know, I sent a copy to Casey. I'd only met him briefly one time a few years before, and I thought, well, you know, he might be interested in seeing this article. You know, of course, it talked about, you know, everything that I've done to help, help build a collection and so forth of his work. And so he got in touch with me afterwards, and I made arrangements to actually soon after that, to fly out to Los Angeles. My wife and I went out there, and we sat down and we talked to Casey. I bet it was for 2 hours. It's
wow.
Just unbelievable how much time, because I had all kind of questions for him and just had all kinds of things I wanted to ask him and you know, share with him. And so the fact that he spent 2 hours with us, you know, just tells you what kind of individual he was. And just a fine man, a true professional, and you know, it's just I'm very fortunate to have had the opportunity. But not too long after that, a radio station in Indianapolis actually was doing a promotion, and they decided to start carrying his program, and so to really build it up with advertisers, they brought Casey to Indianapolis, you know, to actually meet and greet a lot of their advertisers. And the radio station actually took one step beyond that, and they made arrangements for Casey to come to my house to actually see the collection. And it was, you know, just an incredible experience. And so, you know, of course, I had everything all set and everything, and it's just a wonderful experience to have him visit. You know, there's a TV station here that recorded that, and it was just a great opportunity to, again, for him to take the time to meet with a fan, and that's pretty much what I've always been. I've never worked for him. I just, you know, just have been a fan, and so, you know, just a wonderful opportunity, and I certainly was been blessed to have a chance to you know be a part of his program in my own way, I guess. But you know, it's just a wonderful experience.
Well, you know, and it's funny how it goes, because sometimes they say don't meet your heroes because you may be disappointed. But in your case, thankfully, that wasn't what happened. And you know, you never know. I've had both experiences, so you never can tell. But I'm glad that was a positive one, for sure.
Yeah. Absolutely. So.
Yeah. But you were considered to be, I would say, at this point, the official historian. I would say when I tell, I would say you wrote the book on it, literally.
Well, yeah, Rob Durkee's another guy who wrote a book about American Top 40. He kind of took a different approach. Mine is more, I guess, reference material, if nothing else.
Yes.
But Rob actually told a story with his book, and so mm-hmm. you know, I got his book actually was published before mine, and you know, I've certainly acknowledged his book in mine, in my books, but. You know, I consider Rob, you know, an expert as well, and of course he actually worked with Shadow. That's mm-hmm. one of the things that he had the advantage of, working as the statistician with Shadow Stevens. So, you know, that was a great thing. But in any case, you know, just having this opportunity, you know, to be an expert, you know, I enjoy going through the materials that I have, and I just have binders and binders and binders full of material, and just pulling one out every once in a while. Like, for example, this weekend, I believe there's a radio, the Premiere is featuring a program from 1977, and so, you know, I pulled out the 1977 binder, and I started looking at some of the materials, and I have, you know, some of the script cards that Casey used when he answered, you know, questions from listeners, and a number of other things that just, you know, a lot of great things to you know, to kind of reflect on. And I share some of these things on Facebook every once in a while. But, you know, it's just it's kind of a labor of love to have collected all these things over the years and have access to them. And where they're going to end up, I don't know. But, you know, it's just, I say I would have a little bit of a museum, because some of these materials are one of a kind, you know, like having the script cards for Casey counting down the 1975 top 100. You know, it's just, there's just one copy of that. There's no other copy. And, you know, it has his handwritten notes on there and that kind of thing. It's just something special to have.
And, oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. And how are you able to acquire some of these artifacts like that? I'm just curious. I mean, you know, you talked earlier about getting the actual shows, but as far as getting those actual script cards and things of that nature, I'm curious about how you wound up getting some of those.
Well, I, you know, over the years, I've been fortunate to actually meet a lot of the people that worked with Casey. And, you know, sometimes they were able to grab hold of materials here and there that might have ended up being thrown away. In fact, I'm sure there were a lot of things that were tossed that, you know, a lot of individuals who enjoy listening to AT40 every week would consider highly collectible. And so I tried to make arrangements to meet with a few former Watermark staff members here and there, and you know, it just once in a while things traded hands, and so that was one way where I got obtained a number of the script cards. So it just you know, it just being in the right place at the right time, I guess.
Yeah, because yeah, those are certainly unique items, and somebody that had some inside pull, I guess you would say, would be the likely source of getting some of that. So that's good that you've made connections, because yeah, that's fantastic, because those are just incredible pieces of history for people like me who really appreciates that sort of thing. I just think that's just so impressive.
Well, I hope that these materials will end up, you know, somewhere someday where others, you know, have access to them, mm-hmm. because You know, yeah, I have them. And like I said, I try to share some of these things once in a while on Facebook, but I mean, there's so much. But you know, there's got to be some value, and hopefully somewhere along the way they'll get another home. You know, if I had the financial resources, I would actually you know, build a top 40 radio museum, and you know, bring all that stuff in, and then try to get whatever else I could get my hands on to just put it on display for someone to come and take a look at. But you know, that's just not within my means.
Oh, I understand. Yeah.
But you know, I think that's, you know, there's a lot of materials here that some people would really enjoy taking a look at, because either they don't know that they exist, or you know, just part of the enhances the listening to the Casey's Countdown each week. So.
Oh yeah, I'm endlessly fascinated by those the reproductions in the books, and I follow you on Facebook, of course, too. I'm always fascinated by the stuff that you're posting, and I also love those memos from radio stations when there was a song that had objectionable language, and they would there would be warnings. Those are, some of those are reproduced in your books. Those are great too.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Fight the Power is one that comes to mind by
yeah.
Brothers.
Yeah, the powers that be at Watermark kind of let the obscenity found in that record slip by a couple times.
They did.
And,
yes.
and they eventually realized what they were doing and had to fix it. And so they had to notify the stations that they made a little change to it. But yeah, you're right. There were many, many songs over the years where they sent memos to radio stations to let them know that that song is in the countdown, and if it was objectionable to the station's listeners, that the station had the right to delete the song from the countdown.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Mary Wilson's Telephone Man, I know, was one. I think I obtained a copy of the show from a radio station once, that they literally put Scotch tape on the vinyl where that song was in the countdown. So there was no way their engineer could play that song. And I mean, you know, it left, I eventually got that Scotch tape off, but there was residue on there, you know, mm-hmm. blue residue. And so, but you know, there are a number of songs you write like that, My Ding-a-Ling by Chuck Berry.
Yes.
Kodachrome by Paul Simon.
Yep.
Paradise by the Dashboard Lights by Meatloaf.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were a lot of songs that had you know, just an objectionable lyric somewhere along the way, and so stations needed to be careful, you know, so they didn't want to offend anyone.
Yeah, I think I was recently listening to one of the syndicated shows, and they played Firefall's Cinderella, and I noticed they they edited an expletive there too as well. So yeah, that's funny. Those are and I'm glad that when they replay them, they leave those edits, you know. That's kind of funny.
Yeah, it's interesting how that works out.
Yep, it really is. So what was the research process like on doing these books, just out of curiosity, and how long did it take you?
Well, one of the first things I did for the 70s programs was I actually pulled out a listing of every oldie that Casey ever played. And early on, there were sometimes some shows where he played three or four oldies every week.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was curious at first to know what songs he was playing, and eventually I discovered that there were some songs that he played multiple times. And so you know being kind of a geek about this, I started writing down the songs and the weeks that he played them, and eventually I created a file of every song, oldie, that he played, and so that eventually led to the radio stations because early on, I mentioned earlier when I first discovered American Top 40, but I wasn't able to listen to it every week. I tried to find it on radio stations, you know, by scanning the AM dial, you know, trying to every weekend, you know, trying to find American Top 40 on the radio because it wasn't on the air in Chicago. So that was pretty much the next thing I started doing, was going through every show and pulling out every radio station that Casey ever mentioned, because at that point in time, you know, I was just curious to know if there was a station near me that somehow I missed listening to the show on. But it turned out there were a couple stations not too far away, but not they were AM stations, and they were small market and nothing that I could actually listen to every week. But that was, again, just a curiosity. And, you know, then there were stories that Casey told that he seemed to tell more often, you know, just more than once. And so, you know, again, I started jotting down notes about every show and the stories that Casey was telling about different artists and so forth. And so one thing led to another. And then I obtained a few documents here and there. And I thought, well, you know, those might be good illustration pieces if I was able to profile every show and just note every important aspect of each show. And, you know, once that all started rolling, you know, I finally discovered Casey had made some mistakes. There were many, many mistakes over the years, and some of them not really his fault, because the program was pretty much written and just, you know, put in front of him. And so his staff kind of, you know, created the script for him to read every week. And, you know, if they made a mistake in his script, it wasn't his fault that, you know, he read the script as written. And so, but I discovered that there were quite a few mistakes. You know, I thought some of them were interesting, some of them not so interesting, but it just happened. I think there was a 1976, and this one certainly was outside of Casey's realm. He answered a couple of listener questions one show, and I believe it was maybe a month later, he answered the same questions from the same listener. So they must have shuffled the script cards and gave them to him to reread for another show. And so, you know, it's just a, you know, kind of a fluke thing, but, you know, it, sometimes he got the date wrong, because at the end of the show he would provide the chart date.
Yes.
And once in a while he got the chart date wrong. And, you know, just little things like that, but, you know, it's just interesting to find these unique aspects of every show that, you know, made it different from the week before or the week after.
Yeah. You also have notations in there when they would play, and again, this is probably not Casey's fault. In a lot of cases, it's a lot of instances, it is the engineer's fault, I would say, on some of these, the actual records. The wrong record is played in some instances where the flip side may be played, or just completely just played the wrong one altogether. So,
yeah, in 1971, there was a song on the Top 40 for 3 weeks. It was by The Glass Bottle, and it's called "I Ain't Got Time Anymore."
Yes.
But the first 2 weeks the song was in the Top 40, you're right, they played the flip side and didn't realize it until the third week, and they finally got it right that third week. So, I mean, you know, obviously that wasn't Casey's fault.
Yes.
But apparently no one was familiar with the record or the song, and so, you know, playing it 2 weeks in a row, not realizing it. And again, Casey actually was listening to the show and the songs at that point in time when that particular program was recorded. So, you know, it just, nobody realized that the engineer at the time was playing the wrong song. But just another interesting aspect of of the history of the show, and because yeah, that did happen, and you know, just playing the wrong song and Casey introducing it, and so that you know, there was a song in 1970 by Jake Holmes. It's called "So Close." Mm-hmm. I think it peaked in Billboard at number 59, but when Casey's staff obtained the top 40 list from Billboard, and they did this over the phone every week, somehow the person wrote, instead of 59, they wrote 39 next to that song title. And so one week, Casey actually played "So Close" by Jake Holmes at number 39 in December 1970, but in reality, it never actually reached Billboard's top 40. So, you know, just, you know, there are a few stories like that that just, you know, again, makes the history of the show just, you know, they're human. And it's just, there's some interesting mistakes, and it just makes it, every show has something unique about it. And, you know, it's just, just a good part of the program is just, you know, finding, oh, I think there's a mistake there.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, and that's not to say that the Casey's staff were mistake prone. Again, as I mentioned earlier, they produced a top-notch program, and you know, producing a 40-song program, a 3-hour or 4-hour program every week, there, a lot of things went into it, and you know, just every once in a while things happen where, you know, just a mistake here or there, you know, and it's just once again makes the program all that more unique.
Yes, yeah, I would totally agree. And I think they always tracked Casey's voicing on Thursday mornings, from what if I read correctly, that I think it was between the hours of 9 and noon or something like that. He was not to be disturbed.
Well, that changed over the years. You know, when the program first went on the air, it was really interesting. Watermark had access to Billboard's Hot 100 well in advance of radio stations. And when American Top 40 first went on the air, it's just incredible the timeline on how that worked. I believe they obtained the Billboard chart like on a Monday, and then they had to write it. And I think Casey actually recorded the show on Tuesdays at that point in time.
Oh, okay.
And then it was recorded and then duplicated and sent to radio stations on Wednesday, and then it would air that following weekend. So it was, I mean, it was a fast-paced production schedule. You know, from Monday to Wednesday, they had to get the list, write the show, and then produce it and then ship it, and for weekend airing. And it was just an incredible, fast-paced environment. And they did that every week until about May 1971, so almost a year, until they relaxed the schedule, so to speak. And I think, as you mentioned, they might have gone to a Thursday schedule, and it wouldn't have aired that same weekend. It would have been actually shipped out that weekend, and it would have aired the following weekend. So, you know, it's just they had a little bit of leeway to produce the program, write it, and so forth. And but yeah, that's another interesting inside insight to the production of American Top 40 during its early years. And so, you know, they just wanted to provide a very timely program to the affiliates. And it indeed was very timely. I mean, the program that they aired back then, early in that early days of that fast-paced production, radio stations were airing American Top 40 before they actually had their copy of Billboard. And so, you know, they had the Top 40 on the air before any other radio station had the Hot 100. And so, you know, they really had an advantage to beat their competition by having, you know, the latest hits on the air before anybody else. In fact, back in 19, I think it was September 1970, August or September 1970, the Jackson 5 were hot. They had three number one songs. Their fourth song was I'll Be There, and it debuted at number 40. I'm not sure exactly what week it was, but radio stations that were carrying American Top 40 had that song on the air before any other radio station in town either had their copy of Billboard, where I'll Be There by the Jackson 5 was nowhere on the chart. So, you know, it was really an exclusive to have American Top 40 and, you know, the efforts that they Watermark and the AT40 staff put together in order to bring that show on the air at that point in time.
It is pretty amazing. It really, really, really is, especially in those pre-internet days. You know, now you just push a button and it's distributed where it needs to go, but not so much. It was physical labor involved and very labor intensive. And the one thing I wanted to bring up before we end this interview, which I've so enjoyed, is the story about the John Lennon, the week that Just Like Starting Over was number one. There was some reconfiguring that had to be done due to the unfortunate circumstance of John Lennon's assassination. That's an interesting story. I thought maybe I'd get you to tell as well.
Well, I'm not too familiar with how that played out. The only thing I know about is once, you know, John Lennon was assassinated, the Watermark staff for American Top 40, they went back to the studio and they re-recorded Casey's introduction to Just Like Starting Over. And you talk about a fast-paced production. They actually went back to the studio the night John Lennon was assassinated, which I believe was a Monday.
That's right.
Had Casey re-record his introduction to that song, and then Watermark replated a vinyl record to replace the one that had Casey introducing John Lennon that had already been shipped to radio stations. So they actually had to produce a fifth album. It was on a four album set at that point in time. They produced a fifth album with a new John Lennon introduction, and they had to send that out to every, and they were like almost 500 stations at the time, and they had to get that out on Tuesday in order to be received like by Thursday or Friday that week for that weekend's broadcast. And some radio stations didn't get the fifth copy or the fifth issue, fifth vinyl, and so just they had to air the program as it was. But the fact that the American Top 40 staff went back to the studio and Casey came in and they re-recorded the introduction, which reflected John Lennon's assassination. You know, that's a collector's item in itself for some people, because you know, it's just a very unique aspect of, again, one particular show. And so I know you asked me about the change in number one. Unfortunately, I don't know too much about that particular part of Billboard's change or whatever was done with reconfiguring the Hot 100. But I do know that story about the American Top 40 efforts to make the program current, and to actually have Casey introduce Just Like Starting Off Over after John Lennon had died without ever mentioning John Lennon's death seemed, you know, obviously a little awkward.
Yes.
But so that was, again, another great aspect of Watermark and the work that they did in order to make sure that stations were provided with the most up-to-date material, and trying to keep everybody on top of what's happening in the music world.
Yeah, you answered my question correctly. That was a perfect answer, actually. I probably didn't phrase it the right way, so that's probably my mistake, because that's what I was getting at, is how they reconfigured everything and got the show replaced in the aftermath of that terrible event. So yeah, that's what I was getting at. So yeah, it's it was a testament to their professionalism, I guess you would say.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm not going to take any more of your time, but I certainly do appreciate you taking the time to come on to Adam's Corner and talk about American Top 40 and a little bit of the show's history and your books, which I highly recommend people to get. I'm going to put a link in the show notes for your website where people can order them if they don't have
them
already. And
yeah.
So we will urge people to do that.
Yeah, I just, if I can, I'd just like to mention that each of the two books has numerous testimonials from key players with American Top 40. Like the 70s book, there were basically four individuals who helped launch American Top 40. Casey, Don Bastani, Tom Rounds, I mentioned earlier, and Ron Jacobs, who was a top 40 authority based out of the Los Angeles area. Those four individuals helped start American Top 40 back in 1970, and I was fortunate to get testimonials from each of them to be included in the 70s book. So from their perspective of the American Top 40, those are some interesting insights to the show, and and with the 80s book, I have many other individuals as well, and so I'm really pleased that they contributed those writings to help from their perspective see how things were initially programmed to get the program off the air. I'm sorry, on the air.
yes.
On the air, to get them on the air.
Well, you I'm sorry.
No, just some great material that they contributed that are part of the books. And of course, all of them are gone now. They're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pleased that I was able to get those writings in the book, and I think that helps just kind of enhance the story from their perspective of American Top 40.
Yes, and Casey actually contributed one for the 80s book too, which is very, very
yeah,
impressive.
He actually, somewhere along the way, somebody told him that he had different presentation voice styles. And so he actually talks about the five different Caseys. The five different Casey voice styles over the years with American Top 40, and yes, that one is in the 80s book. So, it's a very interesting insight to Casey's perspective of himself and American Top 40.
Yes, it is, and very accurate, I would say as well.
Indeed.
Yes. Well, thanks again for giving us some of your time to talk about a subject near and dear to my heart, and I have a feeling that it's going to be near and dear to a lot of the people that listen to my show, their hearts as well, because there are a lot of us out there. So thanks again for all of your hard work and these great books that deserve to be read.
Well, thank you for including me and inviting me to be a part of Adam's Corner. It's been my pleasure, and always enjoy talking about American Top 40.